America has long been called the land of opportunity, yet as my next guest details in his new book, those who have succeeded via those opportunities over time in many ways have made the door a bit more, well, much more narrow for others to get through. As he also writes, fortunately, there are those who are working to restore more open paths for all at various levels and various paths and platforms is just part of what's detailed in his book, Tailspin, the people and forces behind America's 50-year fall and those fighting to reverse it. He is the founder of the original Court TV, as well as a journalist whose work has been seen in the New York Times Magazine, Fortune, and elsewhere. He's also the founder of NewsGuard, which is a great website. It rates the legitimacy of online news sites, certainly something we need. Stephen Brill, thanks for being here today, sir.
Thank you.
NewsGuardian.tech to learn more about NewsGuard and actually use it because it does provide valuable information. And Ms. Brill's on Twitter at Stephen Brill. So with Tailspin, what was your mission with this book?
I attempted to answer a basic question, which is how did we get where we are today? And where we are today is a country, you know, the greatest country in the world, but with a crumbling infrastructure that's an embarrassment compared to most of the other developed countries, with an education system that spends more on public education per student and produces results that are way behind most of the other countries in the world. A healthcare system that spends more per capita, and again, the results are way behind most of the other countries in the world. A political system that is so polarized that we can't produce a budget ever, any year. Our politics are so polarized that we don't even agree on basic facts. 10 or 15% of the country thinks that still thinks Barack Obama was not born in the United States. And another 10 or 15% still thinks that that 9/11 was an inside job by the Bush administration. I mean, these are just examples, but the overarching problem is that today more than half of all Americans think that their kids won't be as prosperous as they are, and they're right, according to all the economic data. And what that means is that the essence of the American dream has faded from most of the country. And the book attempts to answer how that happened.
You mentioned how extremism has overtaken compromise, almost to the point where if you're trying to be a centrist looking for compromise and cooperation, you're actually labeled the demon in many cases.
You're a sellout. I mean, let's take an example. Let's come back to infrastructure. Our highways are in bad shape, our mass transit's in bad shape, our power grid, our airports are a complete embarrassment, as you well know. Now, compare that to the 1960s, beginning in the 1950s, when President Eisenhower and Democrats in Congress had the vision to say, let's spend billions of dollars and build this thing called the interstate highway system, so people and goods can move around the country. Those roads weren't completed until the 1970s, but here were politicians from both parties in the 1950s agreeing to do something that they would never even get to take the credit for because it would be done after they left. We can't even do infrastructure anymore in this country, which used to be as American as apple pie because the Democrats don't want to give a Republican a victory. The Republicans don't want to give a Democrat a victory. And we're just always, fighting with each other over something that's not a political issue. You know, the power grid or having decent airports is not a political issue.
As I was reading your book, Tailspin, I kept thinking in the here and now, would the construction of Interstate Route 80 have been possible today versus in the 60s, 70s, into the early 80s when it was actually done?
Well, look at, as long as you bring it up, I'm sitting in Manhattan, and you're in New Jersey. What connects us? The tunnel, the Hudson, if we take a train, whether it's a freight train or a passenger train, there's the tunnel, which was built, I think the book says, in 1902 or 1911.
Right.
In 1971, the Port Authority, which is arguably the most mismanaged government agency we have in the country. In 1971, the Port Authority announced that they were going to build a second tunnel to supplement and replace the old tunnel, because the old tunnel was leaking and it was thought to be dangerous and it was way overcrowded and was going to be just, you know, fatally overcrowded. And they said by 1985, if we don't have a tunnel, this thing is going to be an emergency. That was 1971. This is 2019. We still don't have that tunnel. And one day it is, I hate to say it, it is going to collapse. And everybody knows it. Every study has said it. And the Port Authority said it in 1971, which was, what, 29, you know, almost 50 years ago. They said, it's an emergency. We have to build the Hudson River Tunnel. And we haven't done it. I mean, what explains that?
Well, it goes back to what you write about, where one side doesn't want to give the other side the quote, win.
Yeah, and it just never was that way on these kinds of basic issues. And then when you have more controversial issues, God knows you're never going to get an agreement. So political polarization is a part of what I'm writing about. The First Amendment is a part of what I'm writing about, believe it or not, because beginning in the 1970s, a series of court decisions begun, ironically, by Ralph Nader, the consumer, you know, liberal crusader, established a right of corporations to have free speech. In Nader's case, what he was arguing for was the right of discount drugstores to advertise their discount prices, which is something we can all agree with. But that has morphed into what became the Citizens United case. So, you know, another of the great virtues that I write about, a virtue that we celebrate in this country, is democracy itself. Beginning in the early 1970s, we enacted a series of reforms to democratize our politics, and what that chiefly meant was instead of the political bosses picking nominees of parties, we'd have primaries, whether it was for governor or president or representative. The result of primaries has often been, more often than not been, the polarization we're talking about, because when you run in a primary, you have to appeal to either the Democratic base or the Republican base, the people who are most avid about politics and are going to show up to vote in primaries, which usually have a very low turnout. So as a consequence, you know, people running on one side or another take the more extreme positions instead of the compromise positions.
That was Stephen Brill's new book, Tailspin, The People and Forces Behind America's 50-Year Fall and Those Fighting to Reverse. He's also the founder of NewsGuard, NewsGuardTech.com. He's on Twitter, at Stephen Brill. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Speaking of social media, this is something I've mentioned before in what you write about. You had, toward the end of the book, an analogy of someone, I forget the gentleman's name, more people are bowling alone, or words to that effect.
Robert Putnam.
Maybe think of social media, the Facebook and Twitter.
Right. That's another phenomenon. I mean, in every case that I'm writing about are things that were thought correctly to be great advances, you know, trailblazing advances, whether it's a legal strategy of Nader's about the First Amendment or, in this case, technology. So, you know, what's the consequence of that? In the 1970s, the great, you know, the 1960s, the great technological breakthrough was television. Now, television united us in those days because there were only three networks, and they appealed to 91% of the population watched the news on one of three networks. So, by definition, that was mainstream. We all watched the Kennedy funeral together. We all watched the moon landing together. We all watched major events together and saw a common set of facts. Then beginning with cable TV, you could parcel out the audience into smaller and smaller pieces. Then with social media, it became even smaller pieces, so that today, you know, people basically are talking to those that they agree with. Nobody agrees on the same set of facts. So how are you supposed to have a debate in a democracy if a certain number of people sort of start out by saying, well, you know, who says 9/11 was a terrorist attack? I'm in this Facebook group that says it wasn't, and everybody I'm talking to in that group agrees with me. Or, you know, whatever the political issue is, everything is so, you know, parceled out that you basically are, you know, you're bowling alone. You're talking to the people who only share your views, and it is really difficult for a democracy to work that way, especially when another advent of technology, the ability through big data to target people based on their particular views. So you have, you know, political campaigns and propaganda that is targeted directly at people who, for example, feel totally strongly about the Second Amendment, or who feel completely strongly about a woman's right to choose. Whatever the issue is, a politician can target his or her message to the person who feels strongly about that issue. So instead of a message of compromise and unity, what you have is a message of, I'm here to fight for you on the thing you care most about.
As you focus on your book, too, it's covering a period from 67 to 2017. That's a long time for this situation to develop. What's one or two of the ways that a turning point could be created or a restoration can be launched into?
Well, I think the turning point is twofold. First, this is going to sound kind of ridiculous, but I think that there's a history in this country where things can get so bad that they get good. So after the Great Depression, we passed a whole bunch of, you know, New Deal reforms aimed at equalizing society a little bit, equalizing wealth, protecting the unprotected, because in the Great Depression we saw that this was intolerable. So I think we're approaching the point where people are so frustrated and so disgusted, whether it's with political money or infrastructure, you name it, where they're going to demand change. And I think part of the 2016 election is that, you know, the 46% of the people who voted for President Trump were so frustrated that they basically said, well, this country is not working for me anymore. I'm going to try something new. This guy seems a little zany, but I'm going to try something new.
And at the same time, too, those who voted or would have voted for Sanders, the number that sat out when Hillary
right.
became the candidate on that side for the same reason, you know, I'm not going to go with the heritage. I was hoping for a new turn. I'm not going to get my way, so I'll see you in 4 years.
So now what a lot of people hope will happen in 2020 is that people will realize, yes, I'm frustrated, but I really need someone who's going to talk to my problems honestly and is going to unite all of us who are frustrated instead of turning us against each other. And one of the things I point out in the book is that the middle class, the working class, now has more in common with the poor and poor immigrants, for example, than they have with the people at the top. And a politician who can appeal to people in the working class and the poor by bringing them together. You know, for example, the food stamp program in this country is now a middle-class program. There are more people in the middle class on food stamps than there are poor people. And so when that program's cut, as President Trump has repeatedly proposed to do, he's affecting his base as well as the poor. So if the country, whether it's a Republican or Democrat, can turn to, you know, the kinds of political leaders who bring people together, not just with rhetoric, but with, you know, real proposals and a real sense of empathy for them, maybe the combination of that plus the continuing and, in fact, accelerating frustration of people in this country will cause the turnaround that I think is possible.
That's maybe why we've seen on the Democratic side with the fundraising so far. Mayor Pete came in with a surprise, $7 million in the first quarter.
Yep.
He might have that message, as you're saying, is one that's resonating with the proper targeted people, those in the center, those who are living in the real world. It really is an interesting book. I always say history is a great lesson to learn from. Contemporary history is an even more valuable lesson to learn from, because a lot of cases it's a... it's a situation that is in trouble but it can still be corrected as opposed to becoming part of a heritage mistake. Tailspin, the people and forces behind America's 50-year fall and those fighting to reverse it. He's also the founder of NewsGuard, the website newsguardtech.com, on the Twitters at Stephen Brill. Stephen Brill, thanks for being here today.
Thank you.